7. By the time he gets to his truck, his head is a little clearer and he has an idea of how he should go. He starts the engine and backs around to head south, once more being careful not to roll over any of the broken glass. A farm truck goes by headed north. It's hauling a small open trailer filled with lumber. The driver, Gimme Cap, yanked down to the top of his ears, stares grimly ahead, taking no notice of Danny, which is good. When the farm truck is over the rise, Danny pulls out and heads back the way he came. On the outskirts of Thompson, he stops in at a Dollar General and asks if they sell prepaid cell phones, what are called burners in some of the TV programs he watches. He's never bought such an item and thinks the clerk will probably direct him elsewhere, maybe to a Walmart in Belleville, but the clerk points him to aisle 5. There are lots of them, but the track phone seems to be the cheapest. There's no activation fee, and it comes with instructions. Danny takes his wallet out of his hip pocket, ready to pay with his Visa, and then asks himself if he was born dumb or just grew that way. He puts it back and takes his folding money out of his left front pocket instead. He pays with that. The clerk is a young guy with acne and a scruffy soul patch. He gives Danny a grin and asks him if he's going to kick some dickens on Tinder. He calls Danny, bro. Danny has no idea what he's talking about, so just tells the clerk he doesn't need a bag. The young guy says no more, only rings Danny up and gives him his receipt. Outside the door, Danny drops the receipt in a handy trash can. He wants no record of this transaction. All he wants is to report the body. The rest is up to people who investigate things for a living. The sooner he can get this business behind him, the better. The idea of letting it go entirely never crosses his mind. Sooner or later, that dog, maybe with others, will tip the barrel over to get at the meat beneath. He can't let that happen. Someone's wife or daughter is buried behind that abandoned station. 8. 2 miles down the road, he parks in a little rest area. There are 2 picnic tables and a porta-john. That's the whole deal. Danny pulls in, opens the blister pack the track phone came in, and scans the instructions. They are simple enough, and the phone comes with a 50% charge. 3 minutes later, it's live and ready to go. Danny considers writing down what he wants to say and decides there's no need. He's going to keep this brief so nobody can trace the call. His first thought was the Belleville PD, but that's in a different county, and he knows the emergency number for the Kansas Highway Patrol. It's posted in the Wilder High School office and in the halls of both the old and the new wing. In schools all across the state, Danny supposes. Nobody says it's in case of an active shooter, because no one has to. He touches *47. It rings just a single time. Kansas Highway Patrol, do you have an emergency? I want to report a buried body. I think it must be a murder victim.
What is your name, sir?
He almost gives it. Stupid. The body's located behind an abandoned Texaco station in the town of Gunnell.
Sir, may I please have your name?
You go up County Road F, you'll come to a rise. The gas station is at the top.
Sir,
just listen. The body is behind the station, all right? A dog was chewing on the hand of whoever's buried there. It's a woman, or maybe a girl. I covered her hand with a trash barrel, but the dog will get that off pretty soon.
Sir, I need your name and the location you're calling from.
Gunnell, County Road F, about 3 miles in from the highway, behind the Texaco station. Get her out of there. Please. Someone will be missing her. He ends the call. His heart is trip-hammering in his chest. His face is wet with sweat and his shirt is damp with it. He feels like he's just run a marathon and the burner phone feels radioactive in his hand. He takes it to the trash barrel between the picnic tables, dumps it in, thinks better of it, fishes it out, wipes it all over on his shirt and tosses it in again. He's 5 miles down the road before recalling, also from some TV show or other, that he maybe should have taken out the SIM card, whatever that is. But he's not going back now. He doesn't think the police can trace calls made from burner phones anyway, but he's not going to risk going back to the scene of the crime.
What crime? You reported a crime, for God's sake. Nevertheless, all he wants is to go home and sit in front of the television and forget this ever happened. He thinks about eating the lunch he packed, but has no appetite. 9. Now that his drinking days are over, Danny doesn't sleep in even on the weekends. Sunday morning, he's up at 6:30, eats a bowl of cereal, and turns on the KSNB Morning Report at 7. The big story is a 9-car pileup on I-70 west of Wilson. Nothing about a body being discovered behind an abandoned gas station. He's about to turn the TV off when the Sunday morning anchor, who probably needs to show ID to get a beer in a bar, says, "This just in. We have a report that a body has been discovered buried beneath an empty building in the small town of Gunnell, not far from the Nebraska state line. Police have closed off a county road just north of town, and the site is under investigation. We'll update this story on our website and on the evening news." Danny goes to the station's website several times as the morning progresses, also the website of KAAS out of Salina. At 12:15, the KAAS website adds a 40-second clip of police cars blocking the entrance to County Road F. There's one other addition to the story he saw on the morning newscast. The body is said to be that of a woman, which isn't news to Danny. He goes across the trailer park to see Becky. He gets a nice hug from her daughter, a 9-year-old cutie named Darla Jean. Becky asks if he wants to go out and get a bag of burgers at Snack Shack. "You can take my car," she says. "I want to go too," Darla Jean says. "All right," Becky says, "but you go and change your shirt first. That one's all smutty." "She doesn't need to change," Danny says. "I'll just drive through." They get the burgers, plus fries and limeades, and eat in the shade behind Becky's trailer. It's nice there. Becky has a jacaranda tree that she has to water all the time, because, she says, this kind of flora don't belong in Kansas. She asks if there's something on his mind, because she twice has to repeat things she's told him. "Either that or you're going senile." "Just thinking about what I've got on for next week," he says. "You sure you're not thinking about Margie?" "Talked to her yesterday," Danny says. "She thinks her boyfriend's gonna pop the question." "Are you still carrying a torch for her? Is that it?" Danny laughs. "Not likely." "Danny," Darla Jean shouts, "watch me do a double somersault." So he does. 10. That night, KSNB has a reporter on the scene. She looks unsure of herself. Definitely weekend help. She's standing in front of the police cars blocking County Road F from the turnout. "Following an anonymous tip, KHP troopers were called to a deserted gas station in the town of Gunnell late yesterday afternoon. They discovered the body of an unidentified female buried behind the station, which..." She consults her notes and brushes hair out of her eyes. "Which closed in 2012 when Route 119 was widened to 4 lanes. If the woman has been identified, KHP isn't saying. Certainly her identity won't be released to the press pending notification of next of kin. Police are not saying if she was murdered either, but given this isolated location..." She shrugs as if to say, "What else?" "Back to you, Pete."
She'll be identified soon enough, Danny thinks. The important thing is he hasn't been ID'd. He's just an anonymous tipster. My good deed for the year, he thinks. And who says no good deed goes unpunished? But then, just to be safe, he knocks on wood. 11. Pat Grady shows up on time for work every day of the following week. Danny dares to hope Pat's learned his lesson, but he'll never be the worker Jesse Jackson is. As the old-timers used to say, that young man knows how to squat and lean. Meanwhile, information about Danny's dream girl begins to accrete. Although not named, she's reported to be 24 and a resident of Oklahoma City. According to a friend, this unnamed girl had had enough of both her parents and
community college and intended to hitchhike out to Los Angeles and go to hairdressing school. Maybe get work as an extra in the movies or TV shows. She made it as far as Kansas. The body had been there for a while. KHP detectives weren't saying how long, but long enough to be badly decomposed. Dog might have had something to do with that, Danny thinks. She had been repeatedly stabbed, according to a police source. Also sexually assaulted, which was a semi-polite way of saying raped. It was the end of the Thursday night story on the local news that made Danny uncomfortable. The stand-up reporter was older than the weekend woman. Male, obviously part of the A-team. He was standing in front of the gas station where the tarmac was blocked with yellow police tape. Kansas Bureau of Investigation detectives are actively seeking the man who phoned in the original tip giving the location of the body. If anyone knows his identity, detectives hope they will come forward. Or if anyone recognizes his voice. Listen. The screen showed the sort of silhouette some people use to hide their faces on social media. Then Danny heard his own voice. It was awesomely clear, hardly distorted at all. The body's located behind an abandoned Texaco station in the town of Gunnell, County Road F, about 3 miles in from the highway, behind the Texaco station. Get her out of there, please. Someone will be missing her. He was starting to wish he'd left well enough alone. Except when he thought of that chewed hand and forearm sticking out of the ground, he knew there was nothing well enough about it. He snapped off the television and spoke to the empty trailer. What I really wish is I'd never had that fucking dream. He paused, then added, and I hope I never have another one. 12. On Friday afternoon, Danny is using a long-neck mop to clean the tops of the hanging fluorescents in the main office when a dark blue sedan pulls into the faculty parking lot. A woman in a white shirt and blue slacks gets out from behind the wheel. She hangs a satchel-sized purse over one shoulder. A man in a black sport coat and saggy-ass dad jeans gets out from the passenger side. Danny takes one look at them as they walk toward the high school's front doors and thinks, I'm caught. He leans the mop in the corner and goes to meet them. The only thing that surprises him about this arrival is his lack of surprise. It's as if he was expecting it. He can hear faint rock music playing through the speakers in the gym. Jesse and Pat are down there, cleaning up the crap that always appears when the bleachers are rolled back and collapsed against the walls. The plan is to re-varnish the hardwood next week, a job that always gives Danny a headache. Now he wonders if he'll even be here next week. Telling himself that's ridiculous, telling himself that he's done nothing wrong, doesn't help much. The catchphrase from some old sitcom comes to him. You got some splainin' to do. The woman opens the outside door and holds it for the man. Danny leaves the office and walks down the front hall. The newcomers are in the lobby, standing by the trophy case with the blue and gold Wildcat Pride banner above it. The woman looks to be in her 30s, dark hair pulled back in a tight bun. She's got a pistol on the left side of her belt, the butt turned outward. On the right side is a badge. It's blue and yellow, with the letters KBI in the middle. She's good-looking in a severe way, but it's the man who draws Danny's attention, although he can't initially say why. Later, it will occur to him that you instinctively recognize a nemesis when one appears in your life. He'll try to dismiss the idea as bullshit, but he's clear on what went through his mind even as he approached them. Watch out for this guy. The male half of the team is older than the woman, but how much is a question. Danny is usually good at guessing ages within a few years one way or the other, but he can't get a handle on this guy. He could be 45, he could be pushing retirement, he could be sick or just tired. A peninsula of coarse, wavy hair in which red and gray are equally mixed
comes down almost to the top line on his forehead. It's combed back into what looks to Danny like a jumbo widow's peak. His skull gleams creamy, unblemished white on either side of it. His eyes are dark and deep-set with bags beneath. The black sport coat is fading at the elbows, like it's been dry-cleaned dozens of times. He also has a KBI badge on his belt, but isn't carrying a gun. If he were, Danny thinks the weight of it might pull those dad jeans right down to his ankles, exposing a pair of billowy old fella boxers. He has no belly in front, no hips on the sides, and if he turned around, Danny thinks, those jeans would sag on a no-ass that is the particular property of so many skinny-built white men from the Midwest. All he's lacking is a skull pouch pushing out his lower lip. The cop steps forward, holding out his hand.
Daniel Coughlin, I'm Inspector Franklin Jalbert, Kansas Bureau of Investigation. This is my partner, Inspector Ella Davis.
Jalbert's hand is hard, and his grip is hot, almost as if he's running a fever. Danny gives it a token shake and lets go. The woman doesn't offer her hand, just gives him an assessing stare. It's as if she can already see him doing that sad dance known as the perp walk, but this doesn't bother Danny the way Jalbert's gaze does. There's something dusty about it, as if he's seen versions of Danny 1,000 times before.
Do you know why we're here?
Ella Davis asks. Danny recognizes the sort of question, like asking a guy if he's still beating his wife, to which there's no right answer.
Why don't you tell me?
Before either of them can reply, the door at the end of the old wing squeaks open and boom shut. It's Jesse.
We finished sweeping where the bleachers were, Danny. You should have seen all it.
He sees the man in the fading black sport coat and the woman in the blue pants and stops.
Jesse, why don't you...
The door squeaks and booms again before Danny can finish. This time it's Pat, jeans lowrider, hat turned around backward, totally down with it. He stands just behind Jesse, looking at Danny's company with his head cocked to one side. He sees the woman's gun, he clocks the badges, and a slight smile starts to form. Danny tries again.
Why don't you two get an early start on the weekend? I'll punch you out at 4.
For reals? Pat asks. Jesse asks if he's sure. Pat gives him a don't fuck this up thump on the shoulder. He's still smiling, and not because the weekend's starting an hour early. He likes the idea that his boss might be in trouble with the popo.
I'm sure. If you left any of your stuff in the supply room, pick it up on your way out.
They leave. Jesse throws a quick look over his shoulder, and Danny is touched by the concern he sees in it. When the door booms shut, he turns back to Jalbert and Davis and repeats his question.
Why don't you tell me?
Davis skirts that.
We just have a few questions for you, Mr. Coughlin. Why don't you take a little ride with us? The Manitou PD has kindly set aside their break room for us. We can be there in 20.
Danny shakes his head. I promised those young men I'd punch them out at 4.
Let's talk in the library.
Ella Davis shoots a quick look at Jalbert, who shrugs and gives a smile that momentarily exposes teeth that are white. So no skull, Danny thinks, but so small, they're no more than pegs. He grinds them, Danny thinks. That's what does that.
I think the library sounds just about fine, Jalbert says.
It's this way.
Danny sets off down the hall, but not leading them. Jalbert is on his left side. Davis on his right. When they're seated at one of the library tables, Davis asks if Danny minds having their little talk recorded. Danny says he doesn't mind. She dips into her purse, brings out her phone, and sets it on the table in front of Danny.
Just so you know, she says, you don't have to talk to us. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say...
Jalbert flips two fingers up from the table and she stops at once.
I don't think we have to give Mr. Coughlin... Say, can I call you Danny?
Danny shrugs.
Either way.
I don't think we have to give him the Miranda as of now. He's heard it before, haven't you, Danny?
I have. He wants to add the charge was dismissed. Margie agreed. By then I'd quit drinking and hassling her.
But he thinks Jalbert already knows that. He thinks these two may have known who made that tip call for a while. Long enough to dig into his past. Long enough to know about Margie taking out a restraining order on him. They are waiting for him to say more. When Danny doesn't, Davis rummages in her almost a satchel and brings out her electronic tablet. She shows him a photograph. It's of a track phone in a plastic bag, which has been tagged with the date it was discovered in the name of the officer, G.S. Lang, KBI Forensics, who found it.
"Did you buy this phone at a Dollar General store on the Byfield Road in the town of Thompson?" Davis asks.
"There's no point in lying. This pair will have shown the Dollar General clerk his mugshot from when he was arrested for violating the restraining order." He sighs. "Yes, I guess I should have taken out that card thing from the back."
"Wouldn't have mattered," Jalbert says.
He's not looking at Danny. He's looking out the window at Jesse and at Pat, who is laughing his ass off. He gives Jesse a whack on the shoulder and heads for his car.
"The officer who took your call had the phone's number on her screen and the cell tower it pinged on."
"Ah, I didn't think it through, did I?"
"No, Danny, you really didn't."
Davis gives him an earnest look, not smiling, but letting him know she could smile if he gives her more.
"Almost like you wanted to be found out. Is that what you wanted?"
Danny considers the question and decides it's idiotic. "Nope. Just didn't think it through."
"But you admit you made the call, right? The one about the location of Yvonne Wicker? That was her name. The dead woman."
"Yes." He's in for it now and knows it. He doesn't believe they can arrest him for the murder. The idea is absurd. The worst thing he ever did in his life was to stand outside his soon-to-be ex-wife's house and yell at her until she called Wichita PD. The first two times, they just made him leave. The third time, this was after she'd taken out the restraining order, they arrested him and he spent a night in county. They are waiting for him to go on. Danny crosses his arms and says nothing. He'll have to do some splaining, no doubt about it, but dreads it.
"So you were at the Texaco in Gunnell?" Jalbert asks.
"Yes."
"How many times?"
"Twice," Danny thinks. "Once when I was asleep, and once when I was awake."
"Once."
"Did you put a trash barrel over that poor girl's remains to protect it from animal depredation?"
Jalbert's voice is low and gentle, inviting confidences. Danny doesn't know the word depredation, but the context is clear. "Yes, there was a dog. Do you know what happened to it?"
"It was destroyed," Ella Davis says. "The responding officers couldn't discourage it, and they didn't want to wait for animal control from Belleville, so..."
Jalbert puts a hand on her arm, a gentle hand, and she stills at once, even coloring a little. "You don't give information to a suspect," Danny thinks. He knows that, even if she doesn't, and he thinks again, "Watch out for this guy." Davis swipes her tablet, presumably to another photo.
"Do you own a white 2010 Toyota Tundra pickup truck?"
"It's a 2011. I park around back by the school buses, where they haven't seen it, but they know the make and model. And he knows what the picture will show even before she shows it to him. It's his truck in the lot of the Dollar General where he bought the phone. The license plate is clear."
"Security camera?"
"Yes. I have others with you in them. Want to see?"
Danny shakes his head.
"Okay. But here's one that might interest you."
This time, it's a high-res black-and-white photo of tire tracks on the cracked tarmac of the Texaco.
"When we compare these to the tires on your truck, will they match?"
"I guess they will. He never thought he might have left tracks, but should have. Because beyond the Tarvey, County Road F is dirt. It occurs to him that you can be damn careless about covering your tracks, literally, if you haven't committed a crime." Davis nods.
"Also, a farmer named Delroy Ferguson saw a white truck parked in front of that gas station. Same day you made that call from Thompson. He called the highway patrol. Said he thought it might be someone scavenging, or a dope meat."
Danny sighs. He could have sworn that farmer never took his eyes off the road as he hauled his trailer of barn boards north along the otherwise deserted county road. He thinks again, I'm caught. It was my truck. I was there. I bought the phone. I made the call. So why don't we cut through the bullshit? Ask me why I was there. I'll tell you. He thinks about adding, you won't believe it, but wouldn't that be stating the obvious? He thinks Davis is going to ask just that, but the man in the black coat cuts in.
Funny thing about that phone. It was wiped clean of fingerprints.
Yes, I did that. Although from what you're telling me, you would have found it anyway.
Yep, yep. On the other hand, you paid cash for it, Jalbert says, as if just passing the time. That was smart. Without the security camera video, we might have taken quite a while to find you. Might not have found you at all.
I didn't think it through. I told you that. The library is cool, but he's starting to sweat. Color is rising in his cheeks. He feels like a fool. No good deed goes unpunished is exactly right. Jalbert watches Pat Grady pull out, engine blatting and bad valve oil shooting from the tailpipe. Then he trains his somehow dusty gaze on Danny.
You wanted to be caught, am I right?
No, Danny says, although in his heart he wonders. Jalbert's gaze is powerful. I know what I know, it says. I've been doing this a long time, Sonny Jim, and I know what I know. I just didn't want to explain how I knew that woman was there. I didn't think anyone would believe me. If I had it to do over again, I would have written an anonymous letter. He pauses, looking down at his hands and biting his lip. Then he looks up again and says the truth. No, I'd do it the same, because of the dog. It got at her. It would have gotten at her some more. And maybe other dogs would have come once it had the hand and arm out of the ground. They would have scented the... He stops. Jalbert helps him.
The body. Poor Miss Yvonne's body.
I didn't want that to happen. He is still getting used to her name. Yvonne. Pretty name. Ella Davis is looking at him like he has a disease. But Jalbert's somehow dusty eyes never change. He says,
So tell us, you knew it was there, how?
So then Danny tells them about the dream. About the sign defaced to read, Cunt Road Fuck. The moon. The tinka, tinka, tinka of the price signs tapping on their pole. He tells them about how his legs carried him forward of their own accord. He tells them about the hand, the charm bracelet, the dog. He tells them everything. But he can't convey the clarity of the dream, how it felt like reality. I thought it would just fade away like most dreams do after you wake up. But it didn't. So finally I went out there because I wanted to see for myself that it was just some crazy movie in my own head. Only she was there. The dog was there. So I made the call. They are silent, looking at him, considering him. Ella Davis doesn't say, Do you really expect us to swallow that? She doesn't have to. Her face says it for her. The silence spins out. Danny knows he's supposed to break it, supposed to try and convince them by giving more details. He's supposed to stumble over his words, start to babble. He keeps silent. It's an effort. Jalbert smiles. It's startling because it's a good one, warm, except for the eyes. They stay the same. Like a man uttering a great truth, he says, You're a psychic, like Miss Cleo. Davis rolls her eyes. Danny shakes his head. I'm not. Yes. Yes, you are. By God. Three. I bet you have helped the police in other investigations. Like that Nancy Weber or Peter Hercos. You might even know what people are thinking. He taps one sunken temple where a snarl of little blue veins pulse. Danny smiles and points at Ella Davis. I don't know Nancy Weber or Peter Hercos from a hole in the ground, but I know what she's thinking, that I'm full of shit. Davis smiles back without humor. Got that right. Danny turns to Jalbert. I haven't ever helped the police. Before this, I mean.
No?
I never had a dream like that before, either.
No psychic flashes at all? Maybe telling a friend there's stuff on the cellar stairs, so watch out, or someone's going to take a header?
No.
For gosh sakes, don't leave the house on the 12th of May? 12?
No.
The missing ring is on top of the bathroom medicine cabinet?
No. Just this one time? Jalbert is trying to sound amazed. His eyes aren't amazed. They crawl back and forth across Danny's face. They almost have weight.
One!
Yes. Jalbert shakes his head, more amazement, and looks to his partner.
What are we going to do with this guy?
How about arresting him for the murder of Yvonne Wicker? Does that sound like a plan?
Oh, come on! I told you guys where the body was. If I killed her, why would I do that?
Publicity? She almost spits the word. How about that? Arsonists do it all the time. Set the fire, report the fire, fight the fire, get their pictures in the paper.
Jalbert suddenly leans forward and grasps Danny's hand. His touch is unpleasant, so dry and so hot. Danny tries to pull away, but Jalbert's grip is strong. Do you swear? He asks in a confidential whisper. Do you swear? Swear, swear. Three times. One and two more. That you didn't kill Miss Yvonne Wicker. Yes! Danny yanks his hand back. He was embarrassed and scared to start with. Now he's freaked out. It crosses his mind that Franklin Jalbert might be mental. It's probably an act, but what if it's not?
I dreamed where her body was, and that's all.
Tell you what, Ella Davis says. I've heard some terrible alibis in my time, but this one takes the prize. It's way better than the dog ate my homework.
Jalbert, meanwhile, is shaking his head and looking sorrowful. But the eyes don't change. They keep crawling over Danny's face. Back and forth they go.
Ella, I think we need to clear this man.
But he knew where the body was.
They're working off a script, Danny thinks. Damned if they're not.
Jalbert continues to shake his head.
No, no. We need to clear him. We need to clear this one-time-only psychic janitor.
I'm a custodian, Danny says and immediately feels foolish.
I'm sorry, this one-time-only psychic custodian. We can do that. Because the man who raped Miss Yvonne didn't wear a prophylactic. And that left a gold mine of DNA. Would you mind giving us a swab, Danny? So we can eliminate you from our investigation. No strain, no pain, just a Q-tip inside your cheek.
Does that sound all right?
Danny doesn't realize how ramrod straight he's been sitting until he settles in his seat. Yes, do it! Davis immediately dips into her bag again. She's a good Girl Scout who comes prepared. She brings out a packet of swabs. Danny is looking at Jalbert, and what he sees, maybe, is the briefest flicker of disappointment. Danny's not positive, but he thinks Jalbert was bluffing, that the rapist killer actually did wear a rubber.
Open wide, Mr. Psychic Custodian, Davis says.
Danny opens wide, and Davis swabs the inside of his cheek. She looks approvingly at the Q-tip before popping it into the container.
Cells tell, she says. They always do.
Carrier's here,
Jalbert says. Danny looks out the window and sees a flatbed pulling into the parking lot. Ella Davis is looking at Jalbert. He gives her a nod and she delves into her bag again. She comes out with two thin bundles of paper held together with paper clips.
Search warrants. One for your truck and one for your home at, she consults one of them, 919 Oak Drive. Would you care to read them over?
Danny shakes his head. What else should he have expected? Jalbert says,
go out and tell them his pickup's around back. Video them putting the truck on the flatbed so our custodian can't claim later that we planted anything.
She takes her phone and stands up but looks doubtful. Jalbert gives her a smile, showing those tiny pegs that serve him as teeth, and flaps a hand at the door.
We'll be fine, won't we? Danny.
If you say so.
Keys? She asks.
Under the seat. He flicks the key ring hanging on his belt loop. I've got enough keys for this place. I don't need to add more. Truck's not locked. And for once, he has his phone with him. She nods and goes out. When the door closes, Jalbert says,
That flatbed is going to take your pickup to Great Bend, where it will be gone over from bumper to tailpipe. Will we find anything belonging to Miss Yvonne?
Not unless you plant it.
One of her hairs. One single blonde hair.
Not unless
we plant it. Yes. Danny, we'll be taking a ride after all. But not to the Manitou PD. To your place. Just out of curiosity, are there any oaks in Oak Grove Trailer Park? 4 or 5? Maybe only 3?
No.
I didn't think so. There will be some cops and a forensic unit there. Is your house key on the ring with the keys to your truck?
Yes, but the door is unlocked.
Jalbert raises eyebrows that are the same red mixed with gray as his jumbo widow's peak.
Aren't you the trusting soul?
I lock up at night. In the daytime, Danny shrugs. I've got nothing worth stealing.
Travel light, do you? Not just psychic, but an acolyte of Thoreau.
Danny doesn't know who that is any more than he knows what Tinder is. He guesses Jalbert knows that. His eyes crawl and crawl. Danny realizes why he felt the man's gaze was dusty. His eyes have no shine, no sparkle, just a certain avidity. He's like room tone, he thinks. Odd idea, but it's right somehow.
He wonders if Jalbert dreams.
I've got a question for you, Danny. One I've already asked, and you've answered, but this time I'll give you your rights first. You have the right to remain silent. If you choose to speak to me, you don't have to, but if you do, anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to have an attorney present. If you can't afford an attorney, one will be provided for you.
He pauses.
The small white pegs make an appearance. I'm sure that has a familiar ring.
It does. What Danny's thinking is that when he and Jalbert arrive at his trailer, there will be cops there already. Those residents not at work will see and pass it on. Police were searching Danny Coughlin's trailer. By dark, the news will be all over Oak Grove.
You understand your rights.
I do. But you're not recording. She took her phone.
Doesn't matter. This is just between us.
Jalbert stands and leans forward, his fingers tinted on the library table, his eyes searching Danny's face.
So, one more time. Did you kill Yvonne Wicker?
No. For the first time, Jalbert's smile looks real. In a low, almost caressing voice, he says,
I think you did.
I know you did.
Sure you don't want to talk about it?
Danny looks at his watch. What I want is to clock out those two kids and myself.
13. It's what Danny expected at Oak Grove. Two police cars and a white forensics van are parked in front of his trailer. Half a dozen of his neighbors are standing around watching. Ella Davis is there, along with 4 uniformed cops and 2 forensic guys who are wearing white pullover suits, gloves, and booties. Danny assumes she caught a ride to the trailer park with the flatbed hauling his truck, so the neighbors will have seen that too.
Nice. At least Becky's not here, which is a relief. On Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, she has a part-time job at Freddy's Washateria. Darla Jean colors or reads a book while Becky empties washers and dryers and makes change and folds clothes. But she'll find out, Danny thinks. Someone will be eager to tell her. Probably that motor mouth Cynthia Babson. Although his trailer is unlocked, they've waited for Jalbert. Davis walks over to the car. When Danny gets out of the front seat instead of the back, she frowns at Jalbert, who only shrugs. She says,
Are we going to find any weapons in there, Mr. Coughlin?
So no more Danny. And she's speaking loud enough for the looky-loos to hear. Does she want them to understand Danny Coughlin is a suspect of something serious? Of course she does.
38 semi-auto on the bedside table.
Colt Commander. He wants to add he has a perfect right to a home defense weapon. He's never been convicted of a felony, but keeps his mouth shut.
He can see Bill Dumfries standing by his trailer, beefy arms crossed over his chest, face neutral.
Danny decides he wants to talk to Bill when he gets a chance.
Loaded?
Yes.
Are we going to find any drugs, syringes, or other drug paraphernalia?
Just aspirin. She nods to the forensics guys. They go inside carrying their cases. A cop with a video cam follows behind. He's wearing booties and nitrile gloves, but no all-over suit.
Can I go in?
Danny asks. Davis shakes her head.
Let him stand in the doorway and watch, Jalbert says. No harm in that.
Davis gives Jalbert another frown, but Danny is pretty sure they have done this dance before. Not good cop, bad cop, but aggressive cop, neutral cop. Only he doubts if Jalbert is neutral. Davis either. Danny goes up the steps. They're concrete block.
Even after 3 years, he keeps thinking his Oak Grove trailer is temporary, but there are flowers on either side. He gave Becky money to buy the seeds. He and Darla Jean planted them.
He stands in the doorway and watches the forensics guys go through his private space, opening drawers and cupboards. They look in the fridge, his oven, the countertop microwave. It's infuriating. He keeps thinking, this is what you get for trying to help. This is what you get. From behind him, soft, Jalbert says,
they'll give you receipts for what they take for testing.
Danny jumps a little. He never heard Jalbert coming. He's a quiet son of a bitch. In the end, all they take are his gun and a butcher knife. One of the forensics guys bags them, and the other forensics guy photographs them. Video isn't enough, apparently. Danny has 3 steak knives, but they don't take those. He surmises that their serrated blades don't match the wounds they found on Yvonne Wicker's body. Danny goes down the steps. Davis and Jalbert have their heads together. She's murmuring something to Jalbert, who listens without taking his eyes off Danny.
Jalbert nods, murmurs something in return, and then they walk back to Danny. Curious eyes are watching them.
Police visits aren't uncommon in the trailer park, but this is the first time Danny has been visited by them.
Ella Davis says in a casual tone, as if just passing the time of day,
"Have you killed others, Danny? And it just got to be too much for you? Was it guilt instead of publicity? Was the Wicker girl the straw that broke the camel's back?"
Looking her dead in the eye, Danny says, "I haven't killed anybody."
Davis smiles. "You need to come on down to the Manitou cop shop tomorrow. We have more questions. How does 10 o'clock sound?"
Just the way I wanted to spend my Saturday morning, Danny thinks.
"What if I refuse?"
She makes her eyes round.
"Well, that would be your choice. For now, anyway. But if you didn't do anything but report the body, I'd think you would want to get this cleared up."
"Done and dusted," Jalbert says and brushes his hands together to demonstrate. 10 o'clock, okay?
"In case you didn't notice, your guys took my truck."
"We'll send a car for you," Jalbert says.
"Maybe I should rent one from Budget and send you guys the bill."
"Good luck getting someone to okay paying that," Jalbert says. "Bureaucracy."
The pegs of his teeth wink, then disappear.
"But you can try."
Davis says, "Stay close tonight. You can leave town, but don't leave the county." She smiles. "We'll be watching."
"I have no doubt." Danny hesitates a moment and says, "If this is how you guys act when someone does you a solid, I'd hate to see how you act when someone does you dirt."
"We know."
Danny has had enough. "You know nothing, Inspector Davis. Now get out, both of you." She's unperturbed, just unzips the side pocket of her satchel purse and hands him a card.
This is my cell. It will get me day or night. Give me a call if you decide against a further interview tomorrow morning, but I don't advise it.
She and Jalbert get into the dark blue sedan. They drive toward the trailer park entrance, past the sign reading, "Slow, we love our children." Danny walks over to Bill Dumfries.
"What in the hell was that about?" Bill asks.
"Long story short, I found the body of a murdered girl in a little town north of here. Gunnell. Tried to call it in anonymously. They found out. Now they think I did it."
"Jesus," Bill says and shakes his head. "Cops."
"It sounds good. And maybe the doubt Danny thinks he sees in Bill's eyes is his imagination. Danny doesn't care. Bill retired from Dumfries Contracting 3 years ago, and if anyone in Oak Grove knows of a lawyer in the area, it's Bill. He asks. Bill checks his phone, and Danny has a name and number even before the dark blue sedan turns onto the highway. He types the info into his contacts."
"I'm surprised they didn't take my phone, too," Danny says. "If I'd left it in the glove compartment of my truck like I usually do, they'd have it."
Bill says he's pretty sure they would have needed a separate warrant for that, then says,
"They might ask you to turn it over tomorrow. If you got something on it you don't want them to see, I'd trash it."
"I don't," Danny says a little too loudly. People are still looking at him, and his trailer door has been left open. He feels violated and tells himself that's stupid. But the feeling doesn't go away, because it's not stupid.
"Billy?"
It's Mrs. Dumfries standing in the door of their trailer, a double-wide that's the fanciest one in the park.
"Come in here. Your dinner's getting cold."
Bill doesn't look back, but he gives Danny a quick thumbs up, which is better than nothing, Danny supposes. 14. In the trailer with the door shut, Danny has a sudden fit of the shakes and has to sit down. It's the first one since his drinking days, when he used to get the shakes on mornings after until he got his first cup of coffee into him. Also some aspirin. And of course he had them when he woke up in that Wichita jail cell, and there was no coffee or aspirin to banish them. That was when he decided he had to quit the booze or he was going to get into even more serious trouble. So he quit, and look at the mess he's in now. No good deed, etc. He doesn't bother making coffee, but there's a six-pack of Pepsi in the fridge. He chugs one down, lets out a ringing belch, and the shakes start to subside. The lawyer's name is Edgar Ball, and he's local. He doesn't expect to get Ball. It's past 5 p.m. on a Friday evening, but the recorded message gives him a number to call if it's urgent. Danny calls it.
"Hello.
Is this Edgar Ball, the lawyer?"
"It is, and I'm just about to take my wife out to dinner at Happy Jack's. Tell me why you're calling and make it brief."
"My name is Daniel Coughlin. I think the police believe I murdered a girl." He rethinks that. "I know they believe it. I didn't do it. I just told them where the body was. I'm supposed to go in for questioning tomorrow at the Manitou police station."
"Manitou PD wants to..."
"Not them. KBI. They're just going to use a room at the Manitou station to question me. They're giving me tonight to stew, but I think they might arrest me in the morning. I need a lawyer. I got your name from Bill Dumfries." A woman calls something in the background. Ball says he'll be there in 2 shakes of a lamb's tail. And then to Danny,
"I'm a real estate lawyer. Did Bill tell you that? I haven't handled a criminal case since the first year I hung out my shingle. And back then it was mostly DUIs and petty larceny."
"I don't know any other..."
"What time is your interview?"
"They want me at 10.
"At Manitou PD on Rampart Street."
"If you say so."
"I'll represent you at the interview. I can do that much."
"Thank you."
"Then if they don't just drop this, I'll recommend a lawyer who deals with criminal matters."
Danny starts to say thank you again and maybe ask Ball if he could give him a ride to the police station, but Ball has hung up. It isn't much, but it's something. He calls Becky. "Hey, Beck," he says when she answers. "I've got a little problem here, and I wondered..."
"I know about your little problem. Becky says, and it doesn't sound so little to me. I just got off the phone with Cynthia Babson.
Of course you did, Danny thinks.
She says the cops think you killed that girl they found up north.
She stops there, waiting for him to say he didn't do it, that it's ridiculous, but he shouldn't have to do that. She's known him for 3 years. They have sex once a week, sometimes twice. He's picked her daughter up from school, and he shouldn't have to do that. End of story. He says, I'm supposed to talk to them tomorrow, these two investigators from KBI, and I wondered if I could borrow your car. They took my truck to Great Bend, and I'm not sure when I'll get it back. There's a long pause. Then Becky says,
I was going to take DJ to the High Banks Hall of Fame tomorrow. You know she loves those funny cars.
Danny knows the place, although he's never been there. He also knows Darla Jean has never expressed the slightest interest in seeing a bunch of midget racing cars, at least not to him. If it was a doll museum, that would be different.
All right. No problem. You didn't have anything to do with that girl, did you, Danny?
He sighs. No, Beck. I knew where she was, is all.
How? How did you know that?
I had a dream. She kindles.
Like Letitia, an inside view.
Yes, just like her. I have to go, Becky.
You take care of yourself, Danny.
You too, Beck. At least she believed me about the dream, he thinks. On the other hand, Becky seems to believe everything she reads in her favorite supermarket tabloid, including how the ghost of Queen Elizabeth is haunting Balmoral Castle and about the intelligent ant people living deep in the Amazon rainforest.
15. Ella Davis takes her partner to his hotel in Lyons and parks under the canopy. Jalbert grabs his battered old briefcase, companion of 20-plus years of investigations covering Kansas from side to side and top to bottom, and tells her he'll be at the Manitou PD by 9 tomorrow. No need to pick him up. He'll drive his personal. They can go over their plan of attack one more time before Coughlin arrives at 10. Davis herself is going on to Great Bend, where she's staying with her sister. There's a big birthday party coming up. Ella's daughter is turning 8.
Do we have enough to arrest him, Frank?
Let's see what forensics finds in his truck.
No doubt in your mind that he did it?
None. Drive safe, fella.
She heads out.
Jalbert gives her a wave and then heads to his room, giving his Chevy Caprice a pat on the way by. Like his briefcase, the Caprice has been with him on many cases from Kansas City on one side of the state to Scotch City on the other. The two-room suite, far from fancy, is what's known as Kansas Plain. There's a smell of disinfectant and a fainter smell of mold. The toilet has a tendency to chuckle after flushing unless you flap the handle a few times. The air conditioner has a slight rattle. He's been in better places, but he's been in far worse. Jalbert drops his briefcase on the bed and runs the combination lock. He takes out a file with wicker written on the tab. He makes sure the curtains are pulled tight. He puts the chain on the door and turns the thumb lock. Then he undresses down to the skin, folding each item of clothing on top of the briefcase as he goes. He sits in the chair by the door. 1. He moves to the chair by the tiny, almost useless, desk and sits down. 1 + 2 + 3 = 6. He goes to the bed and sits beside his briefcase and folded clothes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 make 21. He goes into the bathroom and sits on the closed lid of the toilet. The plastic is cold on his skinny buttocks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Make 55. He goes back to the first chair, skinny penis swinging like a pendulum, and sits down.
Now add 11, 12,
13, 14, and 15. Makes 120. He makes another full round, which satisfies him. Sometimes he has to go to 10 or 20 rounds before his mind tells him it's enough. He allows himself a piss that he's been holding a long time, then washes his hands while he counts to 17. He doesn't know why 17 is perfect for hand washing. It just is. It works for teeth brushing, too. Hair washing is a 25 count, has been since he was a teenager. He pulls his suitcase from under the bed and puts on fresh clothes. Those he took off and folded go into the suitcase. The suitcase goes back under the bed. On his knees, he says, "Lord, by your will, I serve the people of Kansas. Tomorrow, if it's your will, I'll arrest the man who killed poor Miss Yvonne." He takes the folder to the chair by the useless desk and opens the file. He looks at the pictures of Miss Yvonne, leafing through them. 5 times 1 to 5 added together make 15. She is terrible to look at. Terrible, terrible. These pictures would break the stoniest heart. What he keeps coming back to is the charm bracelet. Some of the charm's missing from the look of it. And the dirt in her hair. Poor Miss Yvonne. 20 years old. Raped and murdered. The pain she must have felt. The fear. Jalbert's pastor claims that all earthly terrors and pains are wiped away in the joys of heaven. It's a beautiful idea, but Jalbert isn't so sure. Jalbert thinks that some traumas may transcend even death. A terrible thought, but it feels true to him. He looks at the pathologist's report, which is a problem. It states that Miss Yvonne was in the oil-soaked ground at least 10 days, plus or minus, before her body was exhumed by the highway patrol, and there is no way of telling when she was actually murdered. Coughlin could have buried her behind the deserted gas station immediately, or he could have held on to the body for a while, possibly because he couldn't decide where to dispose of it, possibly for some psycho reason of his own. Without a more precise time of death, Coughlin really doesn't have to have an alibi. He's a moving target. On the other hand, Jalbert says, he wants to be caught. That's why he came forward. He's like a girl saying no, no with her mouth and yes, yes with her eyes. Not that he could make such a comparison to anyone else, most of all Ella Davis. Not in this era of hashtag believe the woman. I believe in Miss Yvonne, he thinks. He's unhappy that they don't have more, and thinks about doing the chairs again, but doesn't. He walks down to the snack shack for a cheeseburger and a shake instead. He counts his steps and adds them. Not as good as doing the chairs, but quite soothing. He sits in his Kansas plain suite, which he will forget as soon as he leaves it, as he has forgotten so many other temporary accommodations. He eats his burger. He drinks his shake until the straw crackles in the bottom. He thinks about Coughlin, saying he dreamed Miss Yvonne's location. That's the part of him that wants to confess. He'll admit it, and then he's done. 16. Danny is watching something on Netflix without really seeing it when his phone rings. He looks at the screen, sees it's Becky, and thinks she's had time to change her mind about loaning him her car. Only that's not it. She tells him they better cool it for a while, keep their distance, just until the cops clear him of the wicker thing, as of course they will. But see, here's the thing, Danny. Andy's talking about going back to court and suing me, or whatever they call it, for custody of Darla Jean. And if his lawyer can say I've been spending time with someone under suspicion for, you know, that girl, he might be able to convince a judge. Really, Beck? Didn't you tell me he's 6 months behind on his child support payments? I don't think a judge would be very eager to turn DJ over to a deadbeat dad, do you? I know, but Danny, please try to understand. If he had Darla Jean, he wouldn't have to pay child support. In fact, I don't know exactly how these things work, but I might have to pay him.
When was the last time he even took DJ for the weekend? She has an answer for that, too. More weak bullshit. And he doesn't know why he's pressing the issue. It's never been true love. Just an arrangement between two single people who are living in a trailer park and edging into middle age. She doesn't want to be involved? Fine. But he'll miss Darla Jean, who helped him plant flowers to dress up his cement block steps a little. DJ is a sweetie, and an idea strikes him. It's unpleasant. It's plausible. It's unpleasantly plausible. Are you afraid I might do something to DJ, Becky? Molest her or something? Is that what this is about?
No, of course not.
But he hears it in her voice, or thinks he does, and it comes to the same. Take care of yourself, Beck.
Danny,
he ends the call, sits down, and looks at the TV, where some male doofus is telling some female doofus that it's complicated.
Ain't it just, Danny says, and zaps the show into oblivion.
He sits and looks at the blank television screen and thinks, I will not pity myself. I just screwed up reporting what I found, and I won't pity myself. Then he thinks of Jalbert's eyes crawling over his face. Watch out for that one, he says. For the first time in 2 years, he finds himself wishing for a beer.
17. Jalbert lies in his bed, ramrod straight, listening to a prairie wind blowing outside, thinking about the next day's interrogation. He doesn't want to think about it. He needs his sleep so he can be fresh in the morning. Coughlin is the one who should lie sleepless tonight, tossing and turning. But sometimes you can't turn off the machine. He swings his legs out of bed, grabs his phone, and calls George Gibson, who's been heading the KBI forensics unit for the last 7 years. Gibson flew in from Wichita as soon as the judge signed off on the search warrants and was ready to start work as soon as Coughlin's truck was delivered. Calling him is a mistake. Gibson will call him if he has something, but Jalbert can't help himself. Sometimes, like now, for instance, he knows how junkies feel.
George, it's Frank. Have you got anything? Any sign at all that the girl was in his truck?
Nothing yet, Gibson says, but we're still working.
I'm going to leave my phone on. Call me if you get something definitive. It doesn't matter how late.
I will. Now, may I go back to work?
Yes. Sorry. It's just...
We're working for the girl, George. For Miss Yvonne. We're her advocates. Thanks for reminding me.
Sorry. Sorry. Go back to work.
Jalbert ends the call and lies down. He begins counting and adding. One and two makes three. Three more is six. Four more is 10. Five more is 15. By the time he gets to 17, he's 153. He has finally begun to relax. By the time he gets to 28, is 406. He's drifting into sleep.
18. At 2 o'clock, his phone wakes him. It's Gibson.
Give me some good news, George. I would if I could, Gibson sounds beat. The truck is clean. I'm going home while I can still keep my eyes open.
Jalbert is sitting bolt upright in bed.
Nothing? Are you kidding?
I never kid after midnight.
Did you put it on the lift? Did you check the undercarriage?
Don't tell your granny how to suck eggs, Frank.
Gibson sounds on the verge of losing his temper. Jalbert should stop. He can't stop.
He washed it, didn't he? Son of a bitch washed it and probably had it detailed.
Not lately he didn't. There's still plenty of dirt on it from his trip out to Gunnell. No traces of bleach in the cab or the truck bed either.
Jalbert expected more. He expected something. He really did.
Gibson says,
finding fingerprints, hair, an item of her clothing, that would have been ideal. The gold standard. But it doesn't mean he didn't have her. He either did an ace cleaning job inside, or
she was never in the truck at all. Jalbert is hatching a headache, and getting back to sleep is probably going to be out of the question. He could have used some other vehicle to transport her. He's got a girlfriend in that trailer park. Maybe he used her car.
If he doesn't confess, we may have to...
There's a third possibility,
Gibson says.
What?
Jalbert snaps.
He could be innocent.
Jalbert is amazed to silence for a few seconds. Then he laughs.
19.
When Jalbert arrives at the Manitou police station the next morning, fresh pair of dad jeans, fresh shirt, same lucky black coat, he sees Ella Davis waiting for him on the front step, smoking a cigarette. When she sees him coming, she drops it and steps on the butt. She thinks of telling him he looks tired, rejects the idea, and instead asks him what he knows about Coughlin's truck. Clean, Jalbert says, and sets his briefcase down between his sensible black shoes. Which means we've got a little more work to do.
It could also mean Yvonne Wicker wasn't his first. Have you thought of that?
Of course he has. Serials often botch their first one, but if they're not caught, they learn from their mistakes. He could tell Davis there was no bleach residue in the truck, meaning Coughlin didn't use it to clean up blood, other fluid, or touch DNA, but the idea doesn't cross his mind because it doesn't matter. Coughlin did her. The dream story was either a half-assed effort to show off, like an arsonist showing up to help fight the fire he started, as Davis said, or because the guilt has gotten too much for him and he wants to confess. Jalbert thinks the latter and will be happy to help him in that regard.
Miss Yvonne stayed at a shelter in Arkansas City on the night of May 31st, Jalbert says. Her signature is in their ledger. Next morning she buys coffee and a sausage biscuit at a gas-and-go near the intersection of I-35, and help me.
State Road 166, Davis says. She's on the security video, big as life. Clerk saw her picture in the Oklahoman and called it in. Gold star for him.
Jalbert nods. June 1st, just past 8 a.m., off she goes to hitch a ride on 35. And that's the last time anyone saw Miss Yvonne until Coughlin drives out to Gunnell and reports the body. We together so far?
Davis nods.
So when we question Coughlin, we have to ask him where he was and what he was doing between the 1st of June and the 24th when he made that call.
He'll say he doesn't remember, which is reasonable. It's only on TV that people remember where they were. If you ask me where I was on June 5th or the 10th, I couldn't tell you, not for sure.
He punches a clock at the high school where he works. That takes care of some of the time.
She starts to say something, and he raises those two fingers to cut her off.
I know what you're thinking. The time clock doesn't know what you do after you punch in. But he's got those two boys working for him. We'll talk to them. See if he left them on their own for a few hours, or even a whole day.
Davis takes a notebook out of her big bag and begins to scribble in it. Without looking up, she says, school was still in the first week of June. I checked the calendar online. Plenty of people will have seen him if he was there.
We're going to talk to everyone, Jalbert says. Just you and me, Ella. Find out as much as we can about where he was during those 3 weeks. Find out where the holes are, the inconsistencies. Are you up for that?
Yes.
That's if he doesn't confess this morning, which I have a feeling he might do.
Only one thing bothers me, Davis says. How he looked when you told him the perp left semen. What I saw in his face and his body, that too, was relief. Gladness, almost. He couldn't wait to give me a cheek swab.
Jalbert raises his hands, palms out, as if to physically push the idea away. Why would he worry about DNA? He knew it was a bluff because he put on a prophylactic before he raped her.
She says nothing, but there's a look on her face that makes him frown.
What?
It was relief, she repeats, like he didn't know about the rubber, like he thought a DNA compare might really let him off the hook.
Jalbert laughs. Some of these bad boys are exceptional actors. Ted Bundy had a girlfriend. Dennis Rader fooled his own wife for years.
I suppose. But he wasn't very clever about the burner he used, was he?
The frown reappears. Come on, Ella. He wanted us to find him. Now, are we going to get justice for Miss Yvonne this morning?
She considers this. Jalbert has been an investigator with KBI for 20 years. She's been an inspector for 5. She trusts his instincts.
Plus, the story of the dream is such obvious bullshit.
We are. He pats her on the shoulder.
That's it, partner. You hold that thought.
20. The last thing Danny wants is another cop car showing up at his trailer. So at 9:30, he's standing at the entrance to Oak Grove, hands in his pockets, waiting for his ride. He's thinking about how badly he fucked up the anonymous call, succeeding in only making things look worse for himself. And he's thinking about Jalbert. The woman doesn't scare him. Jalbert does. Because Jalbert has made up his mind. And all Danny has is a story about a dream that only a few people, such as Inside View readers like Becky, would believe. Well, he does have one other thing going for him. He didn't kill the girl. As it turns out, he could have waited at his trailer because the cop who picks him up is driving an unmarked. He's wearing his uniform, but sitting behind the wheel with his hat on the seat and the top button of his shirt undone, he could be any John Q. citizen. He powers down the passenger window.
Are you Coughlin?
Yes. Can I sit up front with you?
Well, I don't know, the cop says.
He's young, surely no more than 25. This is Kansas, but he gives off a laid-back surfer dude vibe.
Are you going to launch an attack on me?
Danny smiles. I don't launch attacks on anyone until at least mid-afternoon.
Okay, you can sit up front just like a big boy, but do me a favor and keep your hands where I can see them.
Danny gets in. He clicks his seatbelt. The cop's dashboard computer is off, but his police radio mutters constantly, too low to hear.
So, the cop says, getting questioned by KBI in our little police station. What a thrill, right?
Not for me, Danny says.
Did you kill that girl? The one they found in Gunnell? Just between us, you know?
No.
Well, what else would you say? The cop asks and laughs.
Danny surprises himself by laughing with him.
How did you know she was there if you didn't kill her?
Danny sighs. It's out there now. As Elvis used to say, it's your baby. You have to rock it.
I saw it in a dream. Went out to see for myself and she was there.
He expects the cop to say that's the most ridiculous story he's ever heard, but he doesn't.
Weird shit happens, he says. You know Red Bluff about 60 miles west of here?
Heard of it. Never been there.
An old lady went to the cops and said she'd had a vision of a little boy falling down an old well. This was 6 or 8 years ago. And you know what? That kid was there. Still alive. Made national news. Tell those KBIers to Google it. Red Bluff, kid down the well. They'll find it.
But
what? Stick to your story if you didn't do that girl in. Don't go changing it, or they'll hang you.
You sound like you're no fan of the KBI. The cop shrugs.
They're all right for the most part. Treat us like hicks, mostly.
But ain't that what we are when you get right down to it?
Six-man force, little speed trap outside of town, that's us. Our OOD told those two they can have the break room to question you. We use it for interrogations when we have to, so it's got a camera and a mic.
He pulls up in front. The station door opens and Jalbert comes out. He stands on the top step in his black coat with the faded elbows, looking down.
One other thing, Mr. Coughlin. We all know about Frank Jalbert. He don't quit. Highway Patrol worships him, thinks he's a fucking legend. And my guess is he don't believe in dreams.
I know that much already, Danny says. 21. Danny mounts the steps. Jalbert holds out his hand. Danny hesitates, but shakes it. The hand is as dry and feverish as it was yesterday.
Thank you for coming, Danny. Let's go inside and straighten this thing out, what do you say? The officer in charge just put on a fresh pot of coffee.
Not just yet.
Jalbert frowns.
It's only 5 to 10, Danny says. I'm expecting someone.
Oh?
A lawyer. Jalbert raises his eyebrows.
As a rule, folks who feel the need to lawyer up
or guilty folks, or smart folks. To this, Jalbert says nothing. Edgar Ball shows up at 10 on the dot. He's riding a ginormous Honda Goldwing motorcycle. The motor is so quiet that Danny can hear an easy-listening oldie, REO Speedwagon's Take It on the Run from the N-Dash radio. Ball parks, kickstands his ride, and dismounts. Danny likes him immediately, partly for the huge bike, partly because he's middle-aged, dressed in a golf shirt that makes no secret of his man boobs, and big old khaki shorts that flap down to his knees. Never did a real estate lawyer look less like a real estate lawyer. "I take it you are Daniel Coughlin," he says, and sticks out a pudgy hand. "I am," Danny says, shaking with him. "Thank you for coming." Ball switches his attention to the man in the black coat. "I'm Eddie."